Al-Quds Brigades mainly demonstrated its ability to confront the Israeli scheme and thwart the project of dismantling and separating the resistance arenas from one another, or singling out one specific arena, the Islamic Jihad. Yet, shall we call it the three-day battle, or the battle to establish new rules of engagement made by the past 7 months of 2022, or say the after sword of Al-Quds War, or do we call it the victory of the resistance with hellfire on the army and government of the Zionist entity? Perhaps all of these titles are identical to the results of the recent confrontation waged by the Islamic Jihad resistance movement and its military arm, the Al-Quds Brigades, embraced and supported by the mighty resistance base in the Gaza Strip, which is led by the Izz al-Din al-Qassam Brigades. In his press conference, Ziad al-Nakhali, Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad, stressed that the result of this battle, as well as its main goal, was to unify the battlefields as established by the sword of Al-Quds War, as well as to confirm that the resistance was and still is united despite the diversity of positions within it that pour all in one direction, the war of liberation against the Zionist enemy. The latest Israeli war on the Gaza Strip kicked off after Israel assassinated prominent leaders of Al-Quds Brigades in a round of confrontation that lasted for more than 50 continuous hours. The Islamic Jihad responded by striking the occupied Palestinian territories, starting from the settlements of the Gaza envelope to the Israeli depth in Tel Aviv, with more than 1,000 missiles and shells. Al-Quds Brigades fought back to express the unity of Palestine's land with one aim: thwarting Israel's project aimed at invading one resistance battlefield while excluding others. Israel's central goal lies in getting rid of the effect of the Battle of Saif al-Quds, the Sword of Al-Quds, and its consequences. However, the end result was that Al-Quds Brigades proved its ability to confront the Israeli schemes, crimes, and incursions on the one hand, and fixating the equation of the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds on the other, all the while emphasizing the results of the battle of the unity and interconnection of all the resistance arenas inside Palestine. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip started after Israel assassinated prominent leaders of the Al-Quds Brigades in a round of confrontation that lasted for more than 3 days, in which the Islamic Jihad movement responded to the crimes committed by the Israeli entity and announced the fight for the unity of battlefields. It had the upper hand in striking the occupied Palestinian territories, starting from the settlements of the Gaza envelope to the Israeli depth in what the entity calls Tel Aviv, with more than 1,000 missiles, paralyzing the pillars of the occupation. The outcome of this battle, as well as its main goal, was to unify the battlefields as established by the Sword of Al-Quds War and to confirm that the resistance was and actually still is united despite the multiplicity of positions within it, but with one direction, which is the great battle against the Zionist enemy. Now, to discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan. Dr. Amal Wahdan is a human rights advocate. Thank you very much for being with us from the occupied Palestinian land, Dr. Amal. Now, in the battle of the unity of battlefields operation, Al-Quds Brigades claimed that it demonstrated its ability to confront the Israeli entity and to thwart the project of dismantling and separating the resistance battlefields one from one another, or to just single out one specific resistance group from the other resistance factions in the Gaza Strip. Do you think that the Islamic Jihad, in fact, achieved the goal that it claimed it did?
Yes, actually, the unity of the battlefield, despite all the efforts from the Israeli occupation for decades, who tried to divide these geographic areas, 1948, West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, despite all this, or despite of dividing geographically dividing the Palestinian territory, it didn't succeed, actually, because the Palestinian people and the resistance group have always shown their ability to fight the enemy united. And the latest confrontation with the occupation, the Islamic Jihad, has proved that it could actually unite the different battlefields behind its effort to thwart the Israeli aggressions against the Gaza Strip. Last May 2021, it has been proved again that these battlefields are united behind the resistance and are united in confronting the occupation. So regardless of all the efforts that the Israeli occupation tried to do, they never were able to divide our united effort in confronting their aggressions against the Palestinian people.
Well, Dr. Wahdan, the unification of battlefields that the Islamic Jihad was working for after this latest experience against the Gaza Strip reveals that the isolation of the entity calls for the manifestation of a position regarding the continuous ongoing Judaization of Al-Quds, concerning also the incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the continuous construction of illegal settlements in occupied Palestinian territories, and the raids, the continuous raids against the West Bank in Nablus and Jenin and elsewhere, which all heralds the inevitability of a clash or possibly even a war with the entity. Do you think that the regional resistance has an opportunity today at this moment in history to initiate an all-out war against the occupation entity?
Well, I mean, the regional resistance or the axis of resistance in the region, I definitely can say that it is ready to wage comprehensive war against the Zionist entity, but it depends actually on other factors as well. First, the internal front, the domestic frontier in Palestine and among the Zionist entity itself, and it depends on the international arena. So the ability is there. Their preparedness to engage in an overall confrontation with the Zionist entity is there. I think the moment is approaching where this overall confrontation is going to break out. And the Israelis actually know this, and their strategists always warn the political level of not pushing the area towards this sensitive point where they really have to face a regional front from the axis of resistance. Mm-hmm. So the Israelis are not ready to take this. And if it comes, they know that it's going to dismantle this regime once and for all. That's why the reaction of the Israeli occupation in the West Bank, in Nablus, in Jenin, even in Jerusalem, is accelerating to try to stop any unity in among the resistance in Palestine, inside Palestine, and together with the regional resistance.
As you were mentioning, we did see clashes escalating in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are witnessing basically sort of sporadic confrontations with the occupation entity following a campaign of raids and incursions launched by the occupation, especially in Nablus, as you mentioned, which resulted in the martyrdom of one of the leaders of the Quds Brigades, Ibrahim Nablusi, and his two companions, Salam Subuh and Jamal Taha. We are talking about 19 years old here and 20 years old young men sacrificing their lives for the sole purpose of liberation. How much longer do you think Israel can endure this new blood of resistance?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The more they challenge Palestinians and Palestinian freedom fighters, the more the reaction is on. And Ibrahim, Islam, and Hussein Taha, three young men, were determined, and they knew it. They knew it that at the end they're going to be martyrs during this whole process of liberation movement. And it came actually as an answer to the Israeli incursions and the Israeli aggressions against Gaza. So no matter the Israelis' fierce aggression against the Palestinian, the reaction is even more fierce. Ibrahim, Islam, and Hussein has proven that they are not alone in this battlefield. And the funeral ceremony in Nablus, thousands of people attending this, and thousands of them chanting for the martyrs, this proved that the younger generation is not tolerating anymore of the Israeli aggressions, and they are ready to fight until
it seems
the end.
That the upcoming weeks will just bring about more retaliation from the Palestinian people, who cannot take any more of this kind of oppression and aggression from the Zionist entity. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, for joining us from the occupied Palestinian West Bank. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about how Hezbollah also is threatening the Israeli entity.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
While the official position in Lebanon is still waiting for the Israeli answer that will be carried to Beirut by the American envoy for indirect negotiations, Amos Hochstein, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, during the Ashura commemorations, upped the ante of his warning speeches against the enemy, sending messages internally and externally that the resistance is ready for war if the Israeli side decides to start drilling for gas in the Karish field on September 1st, especially if an agreement is not mediated between Lebanon and the occupation in the remaining few weeks. Observers say that Hezbollah's position has become stronger, especially after the recent Gaza war, in which the Palestinian resistance factions were able to bombard the settlements in the Gaza enclave and even Tel Aviv with more than 1,000 missiles in just 3 days. Hezbollah threatens war against the Israeli entity in this following report.
In a speech addressing thousands of Lebanese resistance Hezbollah supporters who gathered in the southern suburbs of Beirut, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that the hand that will extend to Lebanon's wealth will be cut, stressing that Lebanon's oil, gas, and water must remain his, and that no one should be allowed to rob the country of its wealth and resources. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that they are waiting for Israel's answers to Lebanese state's demands, stressing that the resistance will make the necessary decisions against the backdrop of the Israeli response, calling for readiness for all possibilities. Sayyid Nasrallah stressed that Lebanon can no longer tolerate the looting of its wealth, threatening Israel not to test Hezbollah. Since the beginning of July, developments related to the file of demarcating the maritime borders between the two sides have accelerated after they stopped for several months, following the arrival of an Israeli production and storage vessel to a place near the Karish field, which Beirut considers to be located in a disputed area in preparation for the start of gas extraction from it. The move prompted Lebanon to demand the resumption of negotiations with American mediation at a time when the American mediator Amos Hochstein was satirical in the visit before his last to Beirut, up until Hezbollah sent drones last month to the Karish field, carrying a shocking message to Israel that Hezbollah is more than willing to risk a new war to protect Lebanese wealth and resources. Hezbollah published a video of the incident coinciding with the latest visit of the American mediator Hochstein, putting the Energene platform and other ships in Karish offshore gas field under the watchful eye of the resistance, transforming the American mediator's satirical status into a seriously concerned one. Israel is facing a tough decision that will benefit Lebanon either way. If Lebanon obtains its gas treasure from the sea, which will generate great profits for the state's empty budget, Hezbollah will then prove that his threats terrified Israel, pushing it to give Lebanon back its share. However, in the event Israel refuses to halt looting Lebanese natural gas fields, it will have to face Hezbollah's wrath that will prove to be not only Lebanon's protector in terms of security, but also the protector of its economy. The clock is ticking and the pressure is increasing on both America and Israel. However, an entire year of confrontations with the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, which was able to inflict heavy strikes, one of which was the power station in Ashkelon. Israel fears precise attacks by Hezbollah, which has a more advanced missile and military arsenal compared to the resistance forces in the Gaza Strip.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Ali, now Hezbollah's Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah delivered a speech on the day of Ashura in which he conveyed messages all across the region, affirming mainly the readiness, the capabilities, and the preparedness of the resistance against any aggression, and renewing that Lebanon would never concede any of its rights and its resources. What are the odds that the threats between both sides would actually escalate into an all-out war?
Greetings to you. No doubt that the equation put forth by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah concerning Lebanon's acquirement of its maritime rights, which translates into, first, the recognition of the Israeli entity of Lebanon's right in Lebanese international waters, and second, also to allow Lebanon to extract its own oil and gas. This equation pushed a Zionist entity into a real dilemma. They have no more time to maneuver. As you mentioned in your report, the clock is ticking. Of course, this equation apparently was aimed for the Zionist entity, but in reality, the final decision will not be made by Israel. The equation is aimed at the Americans in specific, because the Americans have a big role in pressuring the Zionist entity to make certain decisions concerning the maritime border dispute with Lebanon. So far, we cannot fully say at this moment that there is a possibility of a war or even a confrontation. We have three possible scenarios. First scenario is that Israel backs down and gives in to the Lebanese demands. This way, they avoid a confrontation, and obviously the resistance will claim that position as a victory versus a disappointment in the internal Israeli arena. The second scenario is that Israel goes down the old road of arrogance and refuses to back down from the Lebanese rights in the Mediterranean, which would lead the region towards a confrontation or a war. Now, the third scenario is that the Israeli entity gives in, but after a limited confrontation, or what the Israelis call combating days, between the resistance and the occupation forces. Something like a couple of days of fighting, in a way that would lead to the mediation of international players, like the Americans maybe, in order to find common ground or a possible solution.
But this is not what the Zionist war minister Benny Gantz said when he threatened to reach Sidon and Beirut if the resistance thought of striking the gas. Yeah, I laughed as well. The gas rigs in the Mediterranean or targeting during operations that are intended to begin in September 1st. But that was before the 1,000 rockets that fell on Tel Aviv in the past week and other occupied cities among which were actually coming from the besieged Gaza Strip. Isn't Israel worried about what might come out of Lebanon from Hezbollah?
Of course, no doubt Israel is very worried about what might come from Hezbollah to establish the Lebanese rights. They're also worried about the damage that will be inflicted against Israel's offshore gas facilities erected in occupied Palestinian waters, which are being usurped by the Zionist entity. When it comes to the threats issued by Benny Gantz against Lebanon, the issue is not only about the missiles launched recently from Gaza towards the internal occupied territories. The issue even precedes the liberation in the year 2000. It is no longer acceptable, hypothetical, or even possible for such a threat to be implemented. The time when the Zionist forces were able to occupy cities or do ground invasions to reach capital cities like Beirut is long gone. These are empty, non-harmful threats, threats that have no real value on the ground. The enemy knows that the resistance is monitoring not only the activity on the extraction vessel in Karish, in Karish, but also the words being spoken on board that vessel. They know that pretty well, and they know what the resistance is capable of. In my opinion, I think all these threats issued by Zionist leaders aim only to raise morale inside Israel and possibly to intimidate the Lebanese public. After the latest round of aggression against Gaza, the Zionists falsely believe that they actually achieved victory in Gaza, and they want us to believe it. They idiotically want to push that false belief to intimidate the Lebanese public and the resistance. From that, one can understand why Sayed Nasrallah, in his Ashura speech, was keen on threatening the Zionist entity and reminding them that we are a nation that does not succumb to Zionist threats. Sayed Nasrallah said the Zionists are the ones who should be afraid of Hezbollah threats because Israel has a lot to lose. Meanwhile, the resistance has nothing to lose. There are three choices today between either the Lebanese slowly dying from hunger or to die in confrontation or to achieve a massive victory. The Lebanese public attitude is one that is widely supportive today of the resistance option because they can no longer endure the economic crisis in their country. So it is longer allowed for the enemy to pirate our rights and steal our wealth.
Yes, but basically this also puts Israel at a very important crossroads in its history, whether it accepts and concedes to the resistance demands or takes the choice of a confrontation that might lead to an all-out war that we don't know who might get involved with it. Many other resistance factions in the region. Which way do you think that Israel will choose to go when we approach September? We still have 10 plus days. Which way do you think they'll go?
I believe that the time limit is not the beginning of September, but possibly mid-September or even the end of September. What the Zionist entity is trying to do now is to extend this time limit by pressuring the gas extraction company to postpone the extraction process by pinning it to technical difficulties. So I think that what Hochstein will bring to the table on his next visit to Lebanon will be to postpone the extraction until an agreement is reached in the ongoing mediated negotiations taking place in Nahura, South Lebanon. But I believe that the Zionists know very well that this dilemma that was created by Sayed Nasrallah will not be solved, neither through a military confrontation nor through a political maneuver. Israel has no choice but to compromise and recognize Lebanon's right in the Mediterranean. And the Americans need to allow the extraction companies that signed agreements with Lebanon, like Consortium, Total, Eni, and Novatek, to begin extraction in Lebanon's Block 9 and the remaining gas blocks. What is happening now is just an Israeli maneuver to try to promote this issue internally because they are approaching Knesset elections in the Zionist entity. So Lapid is trying to insinuate for his people that he did not give in before he tried every possible option. But at the end of the day, we did not want or take you to war. Since we saw what happened to the settlers when for 3 days Gaza rained the internal Palestinian territories in Tel Aviv with missiles, the scenario with Lebanon will be multiplied by 10 times.
السيناريو سيكون مضاعف عشرات المرات مع لبنان وهم يعرفون قدرات المقاومة.
I don't know if the Israelis will be able to put their dead settlers as people who died
via accidents, the same way that they did with Gaza, when that happens, and if that happens. But I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, journalist and political researcher and commentator, for joining us to talk about this very stressing matter for Lebanon, for our country. Thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream. Thank you. We'll see you soon.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The European countries may finally find a solution for their energy crisis. They may resort to old-fashioned ways of burning coal or animal waste to get their homes warm or keep their factories working. But after that, they'd better look for a solution for their political independence from the U.S. How is it possible that the U.S. acts in whatever way it desires, but Europeans pay for U.S. irresponsible actions? In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. Global Times wrote, "The European Union has collectively committed itself to a long proxy conflict against Russia. Despite being critically energy dependent on oil and gas imports from Russia. If, however, you listen to the words of their top bureaucrats, such as Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, one might never believe there is any problem. They talk about reducing energy dependency on Moscow as a quick and painless process, but things haven't been going to plan. Far from crushing Russia, Moscow has been able to make record amounts of revenue in energy exports and reducing the flow of natural gas supplies to Europe, leading to an astronomical surge in energy prices, which poses to throw the Europe continent into a state of economic crisis. Worse still, winter is coming, meaning that demand and cost are only set to increase further. Germany is already rolling out measures to ration the use of electricity, such as demanding all electronic advertising be turned off at night, heating for private pools banned, and limiting use of air conditioners." As the skyrocketing prices of bills hurt consumers, political unrest and discontent is proliferating across the continent, especially given the war in Ukraine is the root cause of all of it, something leaders are simply expecting their populations accept. In the Czech Republic over the weekend, over 70,000 marched in Prague against the EU, NATO, and the energy crisis over the conflict in Eastern Europe. With its government having survived a vote of no confidence over the crisis. Protests throughout Germany are being planned by Die Linke, the left party against the fuel crisis. In Cologne, over 2,000 already marched recently demanding elected officials to put their energy needs over the support for Ukraine. The emerging discontent is the only tip of the iceberg, which will sap the political impetus of leaders throughout the continent to continue fueling the conflict unabashedly. After all, if European leaders cannot readily convince their own populations to abide by COVID restrictions or accept vaccines for their own good, what chance do they stand in compelling them to continue making sacrifices for a conflict that is not theirs? What makes matters worse is that European leaders more readily sacrifice Nord Stream 2, which would have been a solution to this crisis, at a whim on long-standing pressure, coercion and bullying from the US, a country who makes a huge profit out of this crisis through its own natural gas exports, while nonetheless refusing to help in this area. This paints a grim picture for Europe, who will now face a brazen winter of discontent as their own populations grow angry, cold, bitter, frustrated, and out of pocket with the frenzied support of Ukraine at all costs. A crunch is coming. Time also wrote, until blackouts begin or pump prices make driving actually unaffordable, most people generally think no more often of energy than of air. For this reason, Americans have mostly been sheltered from the energy crisis unfolding urgently and in some cases lethally in countries around the world. In many other places, especially Europe, the escalating situation is impossible to ignore and is going to get a lot worse. As a consequence of the rising cost of input fuels, benchmark electricity prices in Europe have surged almost 300% in 2022, breaking records. Taken together, energy prices are 10 times higher than the 5-year average. Not only do average households struggle to pay for power and heating at such a cost, but governments are coming up short too. The $279 billion European governments have recently allocated to help small consumers is already not enough. Britain's National Energy Action Charity projects an increase from 4.5 million UK households to a full 8.5 million will face energy poverty this winter. Kosovo is already suffering rolling blackouts, 2 hours off for every 6 hours on. Brown and blackouts are also expected in other European countries.
تمام
يعني
بازار
Following the success of the first industrial park in 1890, more of these parks began mushrooming all over the world. Industrial zones are viewed as an effective way of increasing synergies between industrial activities through sharing resources. Furthermore, they drive commerce and business for greater economic stability among global and domestic participants. These days, industrial parks are key engines for economic growth and financial security.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to explore Iran's industrial parks. We wanted to see how they are established and operated and who the major players are in this field. Plus, we will examine why industrial parks and estates are so important to the national economy. So, let's get started.
To become more familiar with industrial parks, we visited one on the outskirts of the capital city of Tehran. It was originally launched roughly 3 decades ago and has since grown into one of the most densely packed industrial zones of the province. Spanning some 260 hectares of land, this establishment is home to hundreds of producers active in several production fields. So how does this establishment work, and what makes industrial parks attractive to businesses? One answer is that these zones offer unique services that support investors and companies. However, one of the most important advantages is the large plots of land fitted with the necessary infrastructure for production and distribution. Each year, thousands of tons of products are produced here. Industrial parks also provide vast amounts of space to store goods, and some have their own airports and ground terminals for cargo distribution. But that's not all. Many industrial parks are also situated in economic zones, which offer numerous benefits to businesses while cutting some of their development costs. Additionally, there are other advantages to operating in industrial zones for manufacturers who are also exporters. These include softer customs regulations and certain tax exemptions, among others. As a result, exports from these areas have also contributed millions of dollars to the national economy.
Industrial zones are ideal catalysts for industrialization and economic development. They provide the infrastructure necessary for small and medium-sized enterprises to grow. These parks have emerged as the new super tonic for the unprecedented growth of urban business and commerce. But have you ever wondered how an industrial park is created? It's no easy task. Planning and launching one of these zones is considered an industry of its own.
We caught up with a holding company specializing in planning and developing industrial parks in Tehran province. We wanted to see how these establishments are shaped, executed, and launched. It all starts with targeting the appropriate plot of land. This holding purchases the necessary land, which sometimes can cover hundreds of hectares. This entity carries out its activities under the National Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization. This organization is affiliated with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. So, the holding links various industries with government executive branches and helps remove barriers for manufacturing units. Plus, it connects investors to businesses while handling some of the government's bureaucratic processes for national and international investors. One of the main goals of creating these parks is to support local production and increase exports. Doing so will save the country millions on importing similar goods that can be domestically produced. At its core, an industrial park is a portion of a city or land zoned for industrial use rather than residential or commercial needs. These places can be home to a host of industries and might have oil refineries, power plants, ports, and so much more.
The parks serve another purpose too. They are also meant to protect the environment, as industrial parks collect factories and other manufacturing facilities in an area outside of town. Moreover, these zones foster technological learning and innovation while creating jobs. Plus, such sites provide intermediary support for institutions while promoting interdisciplinary networks.
Their activities support market expansion and reach by providing services to companies that help businesses stay relevant in the competitive market. For instance, this holding company has sponsored various national and international exhibitions where companies in industrial zones can participate. They offer dozens of types of services to small and medium-sized businesses both inside industrial parks and outside these zones. It might be interesting to know that nearly every province of Iran has at least one of these holding companies that establishes industrial parks. For example, the holding company for Tehran province has already established numerous estates and sites over the years, but its activities haven't stopped there. As part of its future vision, this holding hopes to expand its activities, and one of its projects is launching more industrial parks focusing on knowledge-based production. Generally speaking, the number of industrial parks has increased by over 270-fold since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Presently, there are over 1,000 industrial parks and zones scattered across the country. Over 830 of this total has been handed over to industrial units. That's all based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. All things considered, Iran's industrial zones have a bright and promising future while offering lucrative investment opportunities with big profits. The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years.
Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the event. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services.
This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations.
All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into two main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region.
This sector suffered a lot after the U.S. withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials imports. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits.
And now it's time for me to take a quick break and hand it over to my good friend out in the field, who has prepared an exciting report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bedclothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. In the modern world today, felt or namat has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find distress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called namat, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Namat Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices, and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of these disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in the this area, that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reach the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space.
All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is a phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And there's desk divider. It's actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet. And the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Just like linear lighting, almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, the linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose this felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen. I've been Sarah Dema.
We're almost near the end of our program, but before we go, let's take a look at some news and trends on industrial parks and other related traits. As the number of industrial parks in the country grows, so does the maintenance cost of these areas. Iran's Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization, or ISIPO, says over half of these parks are in need of renovation.
The organization says around 60% of the country's industrial parks are over 15 years old and need maintenance and overhauls. Based on official figures, nearly 50,000 industrial units have started their activities in these parks. However, the ISIPO says it is limited in how much help it can provide these industrial areas to effectively maintain them. The organization says the government needs to give it more authority to do so. Iran's industrial parks play a critical role in making the country independent by boosting production in a bid to nullify the U.S.-imposed sanctions on the economy.
Summertime is usually the season where electricity consumption reaches its peak, but unfortunately that's also when most power cuts happen. So, Tehran province officials have now devised a solution to prevent blackouts in industrial parks.
After a brainstorming session, provincial officials have decided to set up several solar power stations to provide a steady supply of electrical power during peak use periods. The power stations will generate up to 1,200 megawatts of electricity for the country's power grid. Plus, these stations will help supply electricity to 19 of the province's industrial parks, where some 6,000 businesses are operating. This solution comes after the Energy Ministry devised a plan to systematically cut off electricity supply to industrial parks during peak use. This program aimed to manage the capital's electricity supply and prevent blackouts for household consumers.
And our last news topic covers Iran's deepening ties with its neighbor, Turkmenistan. The two countries have recently inked a memorandum of understanding.
Under the deal, Iran's ISIPO has agreed to share experience and transfer knowledge related to developing industrial parks to the Turkmen side. These include design, engineering, and consultations for setting up industrial towns in special economic zones. Other topics in the MOU include bolstering entrepreneurship and developing small industries and tech parks. The two sides also signed several other cooperation documents during a visit of Turkmenistan's president to Iran.
That wraps up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.